We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order.
민주주의인민공화국 국무위원장이신 경애하는 김정은 동지께서
North Korea released a bizarre Hollywood-style video this week promoting the country's recent missile test launch.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself.
The drills came after a two-month pause in missile tests from the North ended on Monday.
Flanked by officers, Kim strolls slow-mo out of a military installation.
Now, these deepening ties between Pyongyang and Beijing, but also Pyongyang and Moscow, have changed the balance of power here on the peninsula.
Why is everyone so fucking stupid? Why aren't more people intelligent, like me?
Rocket Man has a new toy. This month, Kim Jong-un unveiled a Bond villain-like missile with an extending tip. On that tip was what looks to be a hypersonic glide vehicle. A hypersonic glide vehicle is the real deal. They're extremely fast, they can maneuver at those high speeds, and we don't yet know if it's possible to shoot them down. On paper, this means that North Korea has more advanced, potentially nuclear, missiles than the West. On paper, this is bad news. But the story gets worse. It was almost certainly given to them by the Chinese or the Russians. Why? Could North Korea be the vehicle to do for the East China Sea what the Houthis have done for the Red Sea? Undermining US power and leaving America's regional allies, in this case Japan and South Korea, scrambling for new, more multipolar patterns of allegiances? Malcolm Cheyune is a columnist for Compact Magazine, a regular writer for Unheard, an expert on modern warfare, and a friend of the show. In this week's special episode, he'll be laying out a broad range of potential futures for the region. But we'll start with Philip Pilkington and the moment of the missile's unveiling.
So last week, North Korea undertook a missile test. Now, we've all probably got accustomed to North Korean missile tests. There's nothing the North Koreans prefer to do than fire off missiles, earning Kim Jong-un the Trump nickname, which will never leave anyone that gets one, of Rocket Man. There's nothing that surprising about the North Koreans engaged in a missile test. But this missile test looked a little bit different to the other ones. If you saw the pictures of it and you're familiar with contemporary trends in weaponry, you probably spotted it immediately. The missile had this strange holster at the top of it that was kind of triangle-shaped, and it opened up, and something resembling a sort of almost a UFO came out of it. It looked like a hypersonic glide vehicle, and we'll get into what that is in a moment. Subsequently, news reports did report that they'd fired off a hypersonic missile. They're always very vague about this because ballistic missiles and normal ballistic missiles can go hypersonic, slightly different from what's meant usually by a hypersonic missile. But a hypersonic glide vehicle is the real deal. It's not just a ballistic missile that can fly at hypersonic speeds. From what I could tell, the reporting initially, I got a lot of kickback on Twitter saying it's not real and all this kind of thing. But from what I can tell, the US Navy has basically confirmed the North Korean report and only disputed it on the distance that the missile or the glide vehicle, they're not being specific, flew. So what is a hypersonic glide vehicle? Well, it is a type, I guess, of missile or missile craft that is fired on the back of a normal ballistic missile, except instead of going out of the atmosphere and doing a kind of a U-shape and upside, or an N-shape, an upside-down U-shape, and then coming back down on its target using the force of gravity, it breaks off from the ballistic missile just after leaving the atmosphere or going into orbit, and then it re-enters the atmosphere, much like, actually, in a way, I saw the analogy used, which I thought was quite good, of the spaceship vehicles that can fly out, the NASA shuttles that can fly out and then re-enter. Now, the difference between this and the NASA shuttles is it goes a lot faster. It flies at hypersonic speeds, which is anything from 5 times the speed of sound to 27 times the speed of sound. Some of these things are reported, at least, or claimed to One thing that they have going for them is speed. They're very, very fast. Another thing is they come in low, and that means that radar can only pick them up pretty much at the last minute, whereas radar, because it kind of goes out in a cone shape, if you can imagine that, it can pick up the ballistic missiles much earlier. And then the final thing it is going for it is it can steer. It can do maneuvers. And the way that the missile people describe this is it zigzags chaotically to its target. What does this mean? Okay, well, a couple of things. First of all, it means that U.S. air defense is almost certainly threatened by this type of missile. Obviously, it's used, I should have probably said at the beginning, but it's used for nuclear payloads. It would be too expensive a vehicle to just use for a conventional payload too advanced. So it's used for nuclear payloads, and it would vastly increase the probability that a North Korean nuclear warhead would get through Western air defense, which should absolutely terrify the West and the United States in particular. Should also be noted that we do not have hypersonic glide vehicles. The West doesn't possess this technology yet. We are working on them, apparently, but they haven't managed to crack it yet unless they've done it in secret. Some people have theories that the UFOs and stuff like that are actually HGVs. But so far as we know, we don't have these things. So that in itself is really fascinating because it means that North Korea, as of today, has more advanced nuclear missiles than the West. And that should just kind of blow people away in a sense. That, you know, North Korea that we've kind of sneered at and talked about it backwards and so on now has more advanced munitions in some sectors, in some crucial sectors like nuclear payload delivery. Question then is, of course, did they build it themselves? No, probably not, almost definitely. I mean, maybe they put the thing together in North Korea, but it was almost definitely given to them by either the Russians or the Chinese. Looking at it, it does kind of look like the Chinese DFZF hypersonic glide vehicle, although it could be the Russian version. Russia have a version called the Avangard. We don't really know. But it was probably given to them by one. There's been rumors for quite some time now that the Russians have been handing over advanced missile technology to the North Koreans. A professor at MIT called Theodore Posel, who's quite controversial, but he's pretty well known in national security and missile world, and he's got a lot of stuff right. He's made some controversial claims as well. But back in August, he claimed that the North Korean Hwasong-18 test launch was actually a Russian Topol-M test launch. So an advanced Russian ballistic missile that could that had the capability of what's called multiple reentry vehicles, which is kind of a it's almost like a cluster bomb of nuclear weapons. And again, this makes it extremely difficult to intercept. Posel also claimed that the thing had decoy canisters that are very advanced and, again, can overcome air defense. So the HGV test, the hypersonic glide vehicle test, isn't in a vacuum. There have, for the past nearly a year, 10 months or something like that, there has been chatter in kind of missile analyst world that the Russians and now possibly the Chinese are handing over advanced munitions to the North Koreans. Now, we can talk about what that means going forward. But I think those facts are relatively well established. Maybe some people could say the hypersonic glide vehicle is fake. I don't really see any reason to believe that. I presume the US Navy would have made that claim. The South Korean Ministry of Defense and the Japanese government Ministry of Defense also weighed in, and none of them claimed it was fake. And also we have this Hwasong-18 test launch, which if you believe Posel's analysis is probably a Russian Topol-M, and the reason to give the North Koreans that would be to allow them to threaten American air defense. So as of today, that's where we stand. It looks like the North Koreans have more advanced missile technology than any country in the West, including the United States.
The interesting thing here is just that, how do I put this? Like, people, once upon a time, they laughed at North Korea as you say, as backwards and primitive and so on. But I think that the shoe really dropped when it became clear that the North Koreans were providing the Russians with more artillery shells than the European economy combined for the war in Ukraine. Then at this point, I think the North Koreans are essentially hitting the American production targets and the European production targets put together. So that could be a case of North Korea being, you know, completely out of this world, or it could be a sign that the issue here is not that they are becoming so much stronger. It's that, like, the West is really not what it was. And I think that there's a couple of real, like, immediate implications of this shift in the way that the relative sort of military levels of power here interact. Because the other thing that's been going on recently in terms of the news, and we've commented on this before, but the Americans have now come out and said that the war against Yemen, the operation, actually, I think people say like Operation Prosperity Guardian, but the specific operation to bomb the Houthis in order to unblock the Red Sea is actually called Operation Poseidon Archer. But Operation Poseidon Archer is now admitted by the Americans themselves to be a failure. They say now that there is no military solution to the problem of Yemen and that they really want a diplomatic solution. So what this means is that the West has now failed against a really, really poor country in order to get them to stop a blockade of one of the most important trade routes on the planet, like the second or third most important. The problem here is just that, like, these two things are just two aspects here of the way in which like the Western military advantage is no longer guaranteed. I mean, it's clear, for example, that the US has more tanks than North Korea. It's pretty clear that they have more aircraft carriers than Yemen. Nobody's doubting that. But once upon a time, these things clearly, like having more aircraft carriers than Yemen, clearly meant that you were in the driver's seat. But now it doesn't. And that's sort of where we are here in terms of like what these new weapon systems do, for example. Would America be in the driver's seat in any conflict with North Korea at this point? Probably not, actually.
I think it's important at this stage to really look at the broader picture here because, of course, North Korea has just tested a hypersonic glide vehicle. I don't see any news as yet that suggests it actually did the sort of things that a hypersonic glide vehicle does, i.e. it kind of doesn't come down at a ballistic trajectory and it is able to maneuver to some degree at hypersonic speeds. But the defeat of Prosperity Guardian in the Red Sea took place with much older technology. And I think that this is a separate trend that we need to consider, is that precision missile technology has become democratized. It's now relatively easy. It's not cutting edge technology to be able to manufacture a missile that can hit either a fairly small target quite precisely or a moving target like a ship, and to mass produce them at a cost that is within the grasp, perhaps not of Yemen itself, because it's receiving them from Iran, but obviously, you know, within the cost level that a country like Iran can afford. And then you have this kind of higher end technology, and hypersonics are, you know, they do, hypersonic missiles and hypersonic glide vehicles do have a series of quite big technological challenges that they must overcome. Without going into depth or into too much detail into these things, they have to overcome the fact that at hypersonic speeds, the heat generated is, you know, quite phenomenal. There can be communication issues with hypersonic weapons given the plasma that's generated around the weapon. There are also issues with the shockwaves caused by, you know, going up Mach 6, Mach 7, or even higher. And finally, there are really serious issues with the sort of engine that's needed to do these. You know, even with modern fighter jets, it's only afterburners that allow them to go at kind of Mach 2 or Mach 3, let alone Mach 6 or Mach 7. So there are really a great deal of technological issues that must be overcome, and it's known that the US has been working on these for a long time, and they haven't been able to fully overcome them as yet, or, you know, as far as we know, they might have at some stage, I don't know. You know, you have these two things happening at the same time. One is an older technology that has become ubiquitous now. And, you know, in the same way that stuff that's on a Formula One car, at some stage it finds itself onto Mercedes and BMWs, and then at some stage it finds its way onto Hyundais and Kias and Fiats, right? In the same way, you've got this, perhaps a bad analogy, but at the same way you've got these kind of precision guided missiles that are either subsonic or just supersonic, and they are able to provide precision strike en masse and at a cost that a great many countries can afford. And then at the other end, you've got this kind of new technology that the US seems to be behind in. Not necessarily North Korea, because as Philip said, it looks likely they were given this technology, but certainly behind Russia and China, it seems. And both of these things look as if they could change the kind of strategic landscape, as Malcolm has said. I mean, is it going to be possible now, Malcolm, in your view? I mean, let's talk fundamentals here. Can a maritime power like the United States and like Great Britain before it now do the sort of things that a maritime power must do to be a maritime power? Can it maintain the Pax Americana, the Pax Britannica? Can it keep open the sea lanes? Can it keep open maritime choke points like the Red Sea, like the Straits of Malacca, like the Taiwan Strait, like the English Channel? Can a maritime power do that anymore? I mean, can a country like the United States project an expeditionary force anymore?
Well, I mean, the short answer here is probably no. And the U.S. Navy in particular is not just battling this sort of inexorable march of technological progress. It's also battling the same thing that the entire U.S. military is battling, which is you have all of these old legacy platforms produced at a time when the U.S. had a much stronger industrial base. And these things have basically become relics from Warhammer 40,000 or something, where you have to maintain them doing a bunch of superstitious techno rituals, because once they're gone, they're gone. You can't replace them. This is true for stuff like strategic airlifters, where the US doesn't actually produce more airlifters. So if some Globemaster or whatever is lost to an accident, well, that's it. There's not going to be a replacement. That's just one less airlifter the US has. And the Navy can't really build new ships at anything approaching like target speed. There was a news bulletin recently that said that, those previous delays in shipbuilding we forecasted, we were a bit too optimistic. The delays are going to be even worse. And so they're even cutting the buys of submarines and so on, not because that's practical, because at this point, like, the pace of building new submarines is vastly inferior. Just looking at the schedule of replay or retirements here, like, it's going to shrink the force. But they had to cut the buys simply because they can't make, like, there's not enough infrastructure to make submarines anymore. So they could either say, we're going to buy 2 a year and then get 1 a year, or they could say, okay, like, we can't make more than 1 a year. So that's what we're going to be buying. What I'm basically pointing at here is that there are inherent, like, just looking at America, there's an inherent problem with the model of force projection, of expeditionary warfare, where North Korea or China doesn't have to do anything because things are kind of falling apart under internal contradictions. But this sort of democratization of precision guided missiles and so on, that's definitely a huge problem. And one should be careful here not to sort of confuse the issue in terms of what has gone wrong for America here in getting behind in the tech race, as it were. I see a lot of people do these sort of really lazy explanations like, it's because of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Like, that's why we can't do research anymore. or, you know, pointing to some sort of generalized cultural, technological, intellectual malaise. And while there might be something to explanations of that sort, one shouldn't forget that in some areas where the U.S. is, you know, enthusiastic, let's just say, the U.S. still maintains a fairly sizable tech lead. So, sure, Russia and China have hypersonics, but they don't have tilt rotors like the Osprey. And for people who don't know, tilt rotors are basically something like a mix between an airplane and a helicopter, meaning that for takeoff and landing, the propellers of this airframe can be pointed upwards, and then they work kind of like a helicopter. And then for, you know, cruise speeds, the propellers tilt forward, so you have something like a normal turboprop propeller plane. These present massive design challenges, which is why the Osprey is kind of infamous for crashing and killing Marines all the time, because the technology is genuinely really hard to figure out. There's a lot of points of failure. And the Americans are pretty much the only ones that have done this. And so, you know, when the Americans want to get the lead in an area, it's not really impossible for them to do so, even today. It's just that the U.S. has sort of pursued a military doctrine of all of these really expensive, really boutique platforms where you only have a couple of them, but they're so powerful that, like, they're going to turn the tide of the war. And it can't really make up for its lack of interest in sort of missile technology, not because the U.S. can't build missiles, but if the U.S. started building all of these, like if they embraced the Yemeni mode of warfare, for example, they looked at the Houthis and said, oh, well, some of the stuff you're doing is all right. I mean, we could probably do it too. If they said that, there's so much of the military that would be obsolete. And so what you see today is kind of a genuine lack of intellectual curiosity from even the smartest thinkers in America. So if you think about all of these realist thinkers in terms of their approach to the Taiwan issue, for example, they're still stuck in the narrative of, well, we still have a bunch of time. Because, like, a naval invasion is actually really hard. You know, doing Operation D-Day, landing on Juno Beach, that stuff is genuinely challenging. And so we in the U.S., we lost it that in World War II, and it was really hard. And the Chinese will have to go back and study World War II and try to do it. But we're warning them, it's not going to be easy. Like, that's still the narrative. Even after the Houthis have illustrated that it's actually really easy to do a naval blockade. And China has, you know, advantages to by, you know, five orders of magnitude compared to the Houthis. Like, they have a much bigger industrial economy. They have much more advanced weapons. A blockade of Taiwan is much, much easier to do. Like, they have military satellites, which the Houthis do not have. And yet, like, nobody in America is talking about a naval blockade as a really serious issue. And it's not because they don't know, because they do. Like, there have been reports and studies done on a naval blockade scenario. All of them that I've seen basically say, this is a giant problem. We don't have an answer to it. But in terms of, like, the public discourse, it doesn't exist. If it did exist, you'd basically have to tear out the guts of the U.S. military thinking and replace it wholesale. And everyone, I think, kind of realizes that the U.S. is a bit too, like, sclerotic and decadent and out of money to really be able to sit down and start over from scratch.
Yeah, and I think it's worth then bringing in, since you mentioned the possibility of the Houthi strategy effectively being replicated in the, say, China Sea, Now, of course, I don't think it's fair to say that that's replication. It's just we'll see it in retrospect as replication. It's due to the fact that other militaries have been thinking about things, as you say, differently to us, who we seem to be either stuck in a mindset of kind of global policeman or World War II. It's like global policeman or World War II. It's like, which one of these is it? And it's never anything else, even though Ukraine looks like World War I and the Houthi thing looks like a naval blockade. And we're like, no, it's definitely World War II or global policing. So that's a big problem. But I think it's worth thinking about in light of, you highlighting the fact that the Houthis, I don't know if we can say the Houthis have won, but the US certainly haven't won the conflict with the Houthis. And there doesn't seem to be any chance that they will, from my perspective. Why then are these advanced munitions being given to North Korea? When there were rumors of it last August, basically, this was before the Houthi blockade, remember. But last August, when they did this missile test that some people were saying was something more advanced than we're used to and maybe even a threat, the talking point was kind of Russia gave it to them because Russia are angry. So the idea was the Ukraine war, the fact that NATO had poured all this money and material into the Ukraine war got the Russians really mad, and they said, okay, well, if you're going to pour all that weaponry in here, we're going to pour some of this really advanced munitions into North Korea. And then they kind of give them a raspberry and they go, what are you going to do about it? At the time, I guess I didn't really give it much thought. Again, this was pre-Houthi last August, but now we're post-Houthi. And they, at least if this hypersonic glide vehicle thing is real, and the news reports say it's real. U.S. Navy hasn't denied it. South Koreans, Japanese haven't denied it. So it looks pretty real to me. If it's real, then I think we have to read it in light. I think your instinct there to read it in light of what's happening in the Red Sea is the correct one. Because the Houthis don't just show that, relatively replicable missile technology can grind shipping to a halt. They certainly have shown that. They also show the power of proxy forces. Now, of course, proxy forces have existed all throughout human history, probably. But I think the level of capacity to use proxies now is becoming more and more powerful, mainly due to the existence of nuclear weapons and the incapacity of any country to escalate beyond a certain point. So not just do we have a kind of a proxy force in Ukraine that's basically a NATO force, Ukrainian NATO force. I think that's pretty widely acknowledged now. I think even NATO say it at this point. And we also have the Yemenis, which are kind of a proxy Iranian force, both equipped by their respective masters, I suppose. That's a bit unfair, but you get what I'm saying. Is then North Korea not better viewed as a proxy player? It seems to me it probably is. So what is the advantage of giving North Korea the capacity to threaten the United States? Well, it seems obvious to me. It means that if North Korea do anything in the South China Sea, escalation can only go to a certain point. I don't know what that point is, but it's definitely, it can only rise to a level that doesn't existentially challenge North Korea. I mean, logically, that's just the case. So I wonder if these advanced munitions aren't being given to North Korea so that North Korea can become a bit of a cat's paw in the region. Where, just to give an example, if anything started kicking off with the US Navy or something, and the Chinese thought, well, we don't really want to start launching anti-shipping missiles at the Navy quite yet, that would escalate things a little bit too far. North Korea could conceivably do it. And the Americans could only escalate that so far if North Korea had a credible technology that threatened the US mainland. So it very much feels to me like, if I'm correct about that, and again, I might be wrong, maybe, but like the pieces all fit, then I think it basically changes the entire geostrategic picture, at least from a military point of view, in the region.
I think there's quite a lot to it, actually. The issue here is that if you think about the American alliance system, a lot of it is pretty much a remnant of the immediate aftermath of World War II. Korea, for example, you have the Korean War, and it's only through the help of direct American intervention that the South survives. And then, for a while, the Americans managed to really put the North Korea on, basically on the back foot, until direct intervention from China saves Pyongyang. And the issue here is that, well, since then, you've had these political alignments basically frozen in time. Taiwan is the remnant of the Kuomintang, who lost the Chinese Civil War and retreated to Taiwan in order to lick their wounds. And then the American Navy comes in and says, well, you can't cross the strait to finish the job. Like, even the countries themselves are kind of like mosquitoes trapped in amber or something, like remnants from an earlier age. And the thing that managed to keep these alignments going was the existence of American overwhelming military power. But the problem is that military power is relative. If I have a nuclear weapon, that's really good to threaten a state. It's not very good in terms of, well, I have a nest of wasps that I want to get rid of. I could, you know, blow that nest up with my nuclear weapon, but I'm going to blow myself up and blow my neighborhood up and destroy my own city. So in that case, having a nuclear weapon is worse than not having anything at all, because you still have to pay the maintenance costs of it. And so the U.S. used to exist in a sort of military logic where having 11 aircraft carriers, that basically meant that you couldn't be opposed. If that changes, if you can have 11 aircraft carriers and you still have to pay the maintenance for it and you still have to furnish the sailors and you still have to keep the airframes in the air wing going, and all of these things are ruinously expensive at this point, but none of this actually allows you to really, you know, sail up to North Korea and tell, you know, dictate terms, then you're in a worse position than if you didn't have those carriers in the first place. And the problem here is that for countries like Japan, countries like South Korea, North Korea is a legitimate threat. It's pretty clear looking at these sort of panels held by think tanks and so on in the Washington, D.C. swamp, that there is a problem of communication between the Americans and the Koreans at this point. Because at every point, at every opportunity they're given, the South Koreans basically say, well, okay, let's say there's a war. How are you going to help us against North Korea? And the Americans just tell the South Koreans, oh, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. They're very cagey about the details at this point, because it's kind of an open secret that if North Korea goes off the leash, there's, like, America doesn't have the resources to help the South Koreans. The South Koreans are on their own, because at this point, the U.S. has stripped the peninsula of not just its own artillery stores, not just its own, like, weapon stocks that it used to maintain in case of North Korean aggression. They've even sort of hustled the South Koreans themselves to give up much of their ammunition sent to Ukraine, and Ukraine is now losing. If there's a conflict with China, the Americans will have their hands full. They will not have the people, the pilots, the ammo to fight again along the border between the North and the South. Like, it's just not possible for them. And the South Koreans are growing increasingly worried that they will be used as, you know, kind of a disposable cat's paw themselves against China, and that there really won't be any help coming in case the cat's paw to the North decides to act against them. And so South Korea, Japan, even the Philippines, they're all kind of facing this question of, like, what use are the Americans to us these days? We used to rely on the Americans for overwhelming military power, so we didn't really have to worry about being attacked, because, like, the Americans could always deal with any threat. And now suddenly the world seems to be full of threats where the Americans are signaling that we're on our own. So what use is this alliance structure to us? And all of this, like support for North Korea, just inflames that tension even further.
I think it's important to think about what sort of a deterrent North Korea could gain by having a credible hypersonic glide vehicle or the sort of analog of the Russian Topol missile that could hit the US and credibly evade all American air defense systems. I think a nice way to enter that discussion and that understanding is to think about the British nuclear deterrent and what it is and what it isn't. For those who don't know, the British nuclear deterrent is a submarine-launched nuclear missile system. It launches Trident nuclear missiles from ballistic missile submarines. We don't have in Britain any kind of missile silos that fire intercontinental ballistic missiles like the Minuteman III missiles that the Americans have. We don't have mobile missile systems like the Russians have. You know, you see those like huge 18-wheel or 18-axle trucks that fire these massive ICBMs off them. We don't have anything like that. And we don't have air-launched missiles. The other thing that we don't have are tactical nuclear missiles, the smaller yield nuclear missiles that can be anything from a couple of kilotons up to a bit bigger than, you know, Nagasaki, you know, 20, 30 kilotons that can be fired from fighter jets, that can be fired, you know, even from artillery, but certainly from multiple launch rocket systems. So what we've essentially got is a submarine-launched strategic nuclear missile. So what does that deter against? Well, the only thing really it deters against, the only thing the British nuclear deterrent deters against is a strategic nuclear attack on the United Kingdom itself. Like, why is that? Well, let's imagine that Britain sends troops to Ukraine and the Russians, launch a small tactical missile with a 5 or 10 kiloton yield. That's a huge explosion. Is the United Kingdom going to respond with submarine launch city killers to that? No, of course it's not. The UK can deter against a strategic nuclear attack on the UK, but it can't necessarily deter anything lower down the ladder from that. And that goes right down the ladder to military defeat on the battlefield in a conventional war. The North Korean deterrent would be different because North Korea, because of its reputation, because of its system of government, because of its entire standing in the world, would be able to credibly deter the United States from certain levels of attacks. We don't know where they may be, but they could include just defeat on the battlefield in a conventional war. It's possible to imagine the Koreans say, look, it looks as if you're going to defeat us, guys. And if we do, you know, we're launching these 55 missiles that we know you can't intercept at US cities tomorrow. So stop. That would deter. I don't think Britain could do that, but that would deter because the Koreans could say, we don't care if we're destroyed. As far as we're concerned, if we lose this battle, we're destroyed anyway. So I think it's really important to understand that the Koreans, if they could, the North Koreans, if they could get such a weapon, could really achieve a great deal of deterrence. And they could actually push the US out of their business, so to speak. They could actually gain a fair bit of strategic room for maneuver through the acquisition of such capacities, essentially.
Very quickly, this is what people were coming to understand when Donald Trump went and met with Kim Jong-un in that very odd moment during his presidency. I think they were coming to understand that at this stage, North Korea could no longer be treated the way it was being treated as kind of an isolated hermit kingdom or whatever you want to call it, and that they'd need to actually be brought to the table. Now, that slipped off the table, as it were, because the world's turned into absolute chaos. My sense of it is that that actually accounts probably for the reaction to the unveiling of this hypersonic missile, and even prior to that, the Hwasong-18, which was kind of a big deal at the time too. It just people weren't sure about it, so I think we didn't cover it on the program. The hypersonic things got a little bit more traction. But just to give a sense, when China dusted off their hypersonic glide vehicle in 2021, remember this is only 3 years ago, I was looking at articles on it, and it was like a China's Sputnik moment. Like, how does the world return from this now that China has such advanced technology? We didn't get those headlines this time on North Korea. And I think the reason is because they are putting themselves in exactly the position that you're saying, Andrew. And we just are so, like, everything's changing so quickly. We've got the defeat in the Red Sea. We've got the Ukraine war going really badly. And then suddenly Kim Jong-un's there smiling next to a hypersonic glide vehicle. And I can imagine, like, the Americans and their allies are just like, we're exhausted. Every light is flashing red in the engine room, and we just don't even know what to do anymore.
To sort of buttress that point and to push back a bit against another aspect of the point you just made, North Korea achieved like credible deterrence in terms of nuclear retaliation or even a nuclear first strike. I mean, like 10 years ago or something, back in the good old days of Obama. And sure, like the Hwasong 17 or even the 16, like how far could they go? You know, would they attack Los Angeles? Could they even do that? Or would they attack Tokyo? Like, people were discussing those things, but at the point where you're discussing, okay, well, maybe there's a 15% chance that this thing can reach Los Angeles and an 85% chance that they're just going to nuke Japan instead. Like, at that point, American actions were already significantly constrained. What's happening now is exactly what you're saying here, Philip, which is like this adds to the general sense of exhaustion. It probably doesn't change that much on the ground in terms of actual like military capability in any sort of relevant sense, because if you can nuke Tokyo, you already have a massive strategic deterrence being able to nuke, I don't know, like Boulder City or something. Like, that probably adds to the deterrence, maybe not that much. But again, what's happening here is just this general pervasive sense of basically the West being overwhelmed. Like, the military advantage is slipping. We do not have initiative, as the saying goes. Like, we are not the ones shaping events. We are reacting to events, and we're doing so pretty badly, pretty slowly. And like, our age and general sclerosis is really starting to show. Like, that's the sense people get in the West, and it's the sense people get in Korea. It's the sense people get in Japan. And the more they get that sense, the more they go, maybe this alliance system isn't a great idea, because we will be the next Ukraine if the Americans don't come through for us. Like, we will be the ones to get our countries destroyed, either militarily or economically or a combination of both, God forbid. And like, these Americans are not looking like all that reliable right now.
I remember in a very early Multipolarity podcast, we interviewed Samo Buria, and he made the point that had never occurred to me before, is that in the event of the Chinese attack on Taiwan, like a full-blown attack, not a single missile or a warning, but a full-blown invasion, it might well be that the Taiwanese elite, you know, the political class and especially the business elites, just say, okay, Let's do a deal. You know, we don't want to see our entire life's work and all our capital destroyed. Let's just do a deal. You know, it could even be that they would welcome the run-up or even the beginning of invasion just so that they can do a deal and finally put the issue to bed, because they take one look at Ukraine or they take one look or one think about what could happen to Taiwan in the event of an invasion, even if it was successfully repelled, and they think it's not worth it.
Yeah, and you could add to that like another pretty obvious problem here. The last figures I saw was that the Congressional Budget Office in the U.S. thought that the U.S. would go have a $1.5 trillion deficit for the fiscal year 2024. But I mean, halfway into 2024, we have a problem, Houston, which is that the deficit up until this point, I think it's the fiscal year, the deficit is now at $1.1 trillion. And so if things keep going the way they are, and they probably won't, they probably will get worse rather than better over time. The U.S., the CBO is already missing its sort of predictions for the size of the fiscal deficit by 50%. And so not only have the Americans sort of lost the plot militarily, but they are so clearly losing even the sort of basic sense of the size of the hole inside their own budget. They're really flying by the seat of their pants in that respect too. And so you can add on top of that, real sort of political uncertainty. Nobody really knows how chaotic the U.S. political system will be once this election is finished. The U.S. is not looking like a reliable, it's not a strong horse at this point. It really isn't. Things like this hypersonic missile test or hypersonic glide vehicle test, these things are additional straws being piled onto the camel's back.
Let me ask a question on that, because we'll probably close soon. You have a better sense of this, I think, than most people. Obviously, we're not making any predictions here. I hope to God it doesn't happen. But in the event of a war between North Korea and South Korea, I don't mean, what would it look like, who would win and so on, but what is the relative power there? I mean, North Korea are obviously a very militarized state. They use most of their economy to have their military, and that kind of shows, I think, in the way that they'd think about war, they'd be more ready for it and so on. And South Korea obviously is a hyper consumer society. With a fairly large military, is my understanding. But Malcolm, do you have a sense of the relative military balance between the two Koreas?
There's a lot of noise to signal here in that comparison, because whenever you ask that question, you tend to get a lot of chauvinism from the same people that said, once the Challenger 2 enters the Ukrainian battlefield, the entire Russian army will be destroyed. Or once the Leopard 2 comes in, damn, those Ruskies will really get the what for at that point. And then, we have the introduction of more and more Western tech, and the Ukrainians themselves say, actually, most of this stuff is actually kind of garbage. We miss our old Soviet rust buckets, because at least those things were good. The problem at the real sort of million-dollar question here is just how bad of a case of this Western conception of warfare as almost this sort of knightly tournament or whatever, where the entire point is to show up with your horse and your lance and your really expensive gilded plate armor. And you win by having the most ornamentation on your great helm and, the most ribbons tied to your lance and so on. So everyone can look at you and say, wow, that guy, that knight is a real badass. Because that mode of warfare has completely failed, and it's being admitted progressively in the West that we simply haven't been taking the idea of attritional warfare seriously, which is why we can't do it. The Russians are fundamentally going to clean our clock at this business, because they actually do attritional warfare and we don't. We just don't do it. Well, if there's any sort of nation you would expect to have this very sort of grim attritional attitude to war, it's going to be North Korea. And as you pointed out, South Korea is a consumerist society that is basically imploding at this point due to there not being any kids. Like, are you going to draft a ton of really old people, like middle-aged people like Ukraine? Yeah, maybe, but maybe not, right? And so you add that sort of, I would almost say, like societal, civilizational problem of attitude and like towards warfare. But then you have the constant American looting of not only its own sort of stocks of ammunition and spare parts and so on, but also the looting of the South Korean armories as well, which has apparently been fairly thorough. It's actually like a huge point of weakness, even at the best of times, for this sort of high-tech mode of warfare that, generally speaking, like a lot of militaries don't have ammo for more than a couple of weeks of conflict. Like, there's no military in Europe, for example, that really has stocks for, at this point, it's more than like 2 weeks or something of a war against the Russians. But before this war began, I don't think many militaries really thought they could last in this kind of high-intensity warfare for more than 90 days at the top end. And so with that inherent weakness from the start, and with North Korea, which is obviously not susceptible to that kind of thing, which is why they've been outproducing Europe in terms of artillery shells, outproducing America even. I mean, they could really easily be in it for the long haul, and there are a lot of question marks about like whether Korea, South Korea, could be in it for the long haul. So without making any sort of definitive predictions, I think there's very, very good reasons to be seriously worried if you're in like a South Korean military planner. I would honestly give the advantage to North Koreans, but obviously I was going to do that like regardless of the facts of the ground, obviously.
Thank you.